Shannon, we had so much fun when Alan Abel, the former outstanding columnist with the Globe and Mail, was with us a few weeks ago. We decided to invite him back. There's no better storyteller, and I assume we'll spend the entire program listening to Abel tell us stories about various things.
Well, nobody loves the history of sports and loves politics better. And is there a better combination than sports and politics?
Well, I don't know of one.
No, it's fantastic.
Less of us and more of him. Alan Abel joins us after these messages. Yours truly, Bob McCallum, with John Shannon over there. And our friend Alan Abel rejoins us and is, for those of you not watching this episode, Abel apparently felt underdressed the last time he was on, so he got all dolled up here on a Monday while Shannon and I are in our backyard work clothes.
You're very, because
my daughter has pajama day today.
You're very intimidating, Bob. You know, you scare the heck out of people. So
I have no recollection of what I wore the last time you were on, Abel.
But you might have worn a sports coat.
I did.
Oh, he didn't wear a three-piece suit. He does it.
He did.
Well, he does own one, but it was from 1978. So the flare collars
I can see the Goodwill label on it.
Yeah. Flare collars and cuffs on the pants.
Well, what's wrong with you two? Like you don't think a suit should last 50 years?
Okay, Mr. Travolta.
At the very least, it should come back into style. There are only so many styles.
I bet Trump has had lawsuits that lasted 50 years.
Well, he may be about to get into one.
See, we haven't brought his name up for at least 4 weeks on this show. At least 4 weeks.
I saw him almost every day for 4 years.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Well, not to jump on that bandwagon, but does this guy wind up a free man the rest of his life, or do you think he's going to prison at some point?
Oh, stop.
Do I think he's going to prison? That's probably unlikely. Do I think he's in for some messy times in the Southern District of New York State? Probably. Yeah. If it's in the political interest of those prosecutors to do that. And it probably is, especially if any of his family decide to get into New York State politics.
Well, and especially...
Does he go to prison? No, I think if Ford pardoned Nixon, I think at some point Kamala Harris or Lara Trump or whoever the next president is in a few years pardons Donald Trump, I think. But that's...
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I think the precedent was set by Gerald Ford when he gave Nixon a blanket pardon, though Nixon hadn't been charged with any crimes at all.
That's right.
And said, this guy's not... I don't think the spectacle of Trump behind bars is a necessary one. In his late 70s?
I don't disagree with that necessarily.
He even pardoned Kushner's father.
Well, you said if it's in the political interest of the, especially the people in New York and around New York City, and you would know that that is a very democratic region.
Well, the state of Georgia is supposedly investigating his conduct in appealing for election fraud there or whatever he told the governor there. Kemp just find me the votes, which is sort of a Richard Daley, Joe Kennedy kind of conversation. But no reason to think that the people in Georgia, the state legislature in Georgia, want to see Trump in prison. But that's a discussion for another day.
Well, perhaps. The only thing I will say is that the majority of the ruling parties traditionally and currently in Georgia are Republicans. And I don't know how that will play into the...
Well, they just elected two Democratic senators.
Well, I get that. But the governor's a Republican. And
and the court system, I would think. I'm no expert on the Georgia state judiciary, but I would think that's mostly Republican appointees.
Well, it's been a Republican stronghold for decades.
Okay, enough of Face the Nation here. Here we go. Come on.
You went to Yankee Stadium for the opening series against the
last Sunday
Blue Jays, yeah.
And I was with a fellow who'd never been up there, and he wanted to make a pilgrimage, so we went to Monument Park and looked around the place. And it's the place I started going to. My first game there was 1958, but of course that's not the there that's there.
No, it's just next door.
It's a mock-up of it. But it's effective, and the monuments are still there, though. I think they've cheapened Monument Park. I think you're equating their Babe Ruth with Tino Martinez, or vice versa. And Paul O'Neill, and are these legends worthy of Garrick Ruth and DiMaggio? But it sells, and it's
that's an interesting question, because generations measure legends, and those of us that are a little older, you know, because we remember back, you know, I mean, this is like the famous line about when Kennedy was shot, and somebody turns and says Ted Kennedy was shot. You know, it's all relative to the generation you live in. So for Paul O'Neill and Edgar Martinez, were great Yankees to a guy that's 27 or 34.
Yeah, you didn't see Ruth play. You never saw Garrick.
No, I know. That's
first,
right.
The first three monuments were Ruth, Garrick, and Miller Huggins. Who knows Miller Huggins? You know the biggest plaque there is Steinbrenner?
Is it really?
I'm shocked.
Yeah. With language that would come, I mean, this, it's not a mystery that Trump envied or was an acolyte of Steinbrenner, that he wished he had owned the Yankees. But it's like this, a great humanitarian, great sportsman, obviously penned by George himself, and a plaque twice the size of even Pope John the 23rd. So he owned the building. He could put whatever he wanted on it. And there's even a permanent picture of Steinbrenner on the scoreboard that never goes away. The boss with his picture on it.
On the video board?
Yeah. If you own the place, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Well, so we went, but the interesting thing was watching how they scatter. They listed a crowd of 11,000. There couldn't have been more than 4,000 or 5,000 people in the ballpark. And it's strange to look around and see 8 people in section 422 and 8 people in section 309 and 12 people. I think there were 7 people in our section. And so you have the mask police, the ushers, because it was so early in the season that they were probably still expecting that the supervisors were looking at them, watching them. So they had a little sign they held up. One side was a picture of a face with a mask on it, and the other side said, please. But if you were eating, you don't have to wear a mask. So if you had a bag of peanuts, you could stretch that out for 9 innings. And of course, to get in, you show either a vaccination card or you got COVID tested within a few hours before at a walk-in clinic. So theoretically, nobody in the ballpark is contagious anyway. But they still were enforcing the masks. Some of the concessions were open, some were closed. Sort of a strange experience, but not that strange if you went to early season ball games when there often were only 10,000 people in the center. Just that they were so spread out. It wasn't everybody got down close. I would imagine in a few weeks, once the ushers aren't afraid of being written up, that you'll be able to slip a guy at 10 or 20 and get to a better seat. But it was an interesting experience, because otherwise it was just a ball game.
You used the phrase, Abel, you didn't have to wear your mask when you were eating. Can you please explain to me how you would wear your mask when you were eating?
You could slip food underneath it, I guess, somehow. One peanut at a time. It'd be more difficult with a hot dog.
You can't. That's not an
option.
You
could insert the food into your mouth and then replace the mask for the exhalations.
I'm wondering when would have been the last time the New York Yankees played in front of 4,000 people at home. And you might have to go back to the early 70s when Steinbrenner bought the team from CBS. I think it was 73 George bought the team. And at that point, the Yankees were a miserable lot, and New York basically paid no attention to them.
Well, their last pennant in that run was 64. And I think by 66, they finished last.
Right. Yeah.
I believe. And I used to go whenever the Senators were in town, because I was on the Washington Senators in Little League. So we'd go to the stadium to see the Nats, as they were called. Oh, and they were then, there would be nobody there, unless it was a giveaway or a Sunday doubleheader.
See, now you...
The afternoon, Kansas City A's, Washington Senator. It might only have drawn 5,000 or 6,000.
Yeah.
See, now you, Alan, you've opened the door, because we're going to hear for the 10 millionth time the fact that you played for the Senators as a boy, and Bob little Bobby played for the Dodgers, and That's he wore right. the Dodgers and the Dodgers, and he became a Dodger fan, and they were yellow. It wasn't blue. It was yellow. You know what I mean? We're going to hear that story again.
Well, but you see, Abel is doing nothing more than justifying, you know, because I get asked, you know, you didn't get asked. You just explained your relationship to the Senators. And it's the exact same reason why I became a Dodger fan. I was
why was it, Bob? Tell me why.
Because I my first baseball team was the Dodgers. I had no idea who they were. I was 6 years old. And they and that very fall they moved to Los Angeles.
It's like being indoctrinated into the Proud Boys. There's no difference.
I imagine that identical.
This is online, that was on the field. 2 years in left field in Little League, never had a ball hit to me, so the last game went right through my legs.
Did it really? Well, did they give you the error or
I knew the score. I don't think I ever hit the ball either. I seem to recall everyone either walked or struck out.
You got the participation trophy, though. Alan Abel,
not
second.
In 1959, you didn't.
Oh, yeah, that's another edition of the 70s and 80s. That's right, the participation award.
So I have not been to, I guess, can you still call it the new Yankee Stadium? I guess you can.
No, there's only one Yankee Stadium.
Well, no, but I mean, there was one. There was one that was renovated many times, and then they built a new one.
It's gone. It's gone, Bob.
Well, I haven't been to the one that's there now. I went to the old one. Compare the two, because you have been to both numerous times.
Well, one is Yankee Stadium, one isn't. That's
so what's there now is some imposter.
No, it's not an imposter. It's just a different edifice, but it has the monuments.
Yeah.
And it has the molding along the top, obviously not the same, but it's just a modern 21st century stadium with 21st century beer prices.
Hold on, the monuments aren't in the field of play anymore, though.
No,
I mean
center field was 461 to center field.
That's right. I mean, that was always the amazing thing. Is I remember watching footage in the 60s of the ball going between the monuments, and whoever was in center field, whether it was Mantle or the visiting team, having to go and try to dodge it and find the baseball. It was like,
doubt that happened very often.
It was like street ball.
Well, Polo Grounds had a monument too to Eddie Grant, who had been a former Giant player who was killed in World War One. There was a monument there. Mays's famous catch, he's to the right field side of the monument. But I think Polo Grounds was 455 or maybe even longer than that.
So did
461, you could put a herd of cattle out there. No one's going to hit the ball out there anyway.
So Alan, you were at the original Yankee Stadium, Ebbets Field?
Ebbets Field once when I was 7. All I remember is Emmett Kelly the Clown.
No kidding. Well, he was there, was he?
Yeah.
It was their last weekend.
Oh. So Ebbets Field and then the Polo Grounds. Which one did
Polo Grounds many times when the Mets were there?
Okay. So, these places are iconic for a New York baseball fan, but they really weren't that big, were they? I mean, they were under 35,000 seats. The Yankee Stadium was.
Ebbets Field was under 35,000. The Polo Grounds was more built almost for football.
Right.
It was a horseshoe, and that would have probably fit 55 or 6. And Yankee Stadium had crowds over 60,000.
No, Yankee Stadium, I know, but I didn't realize the Polo Grounds was that big. I thought it was a smaller stadium as well.
Was it built for the Giants?
It was built in 1911, and the previous stadium had burnt down. There was a stadium called the Polo Grounds. It burnt down. I think it caught fire on opening day in 1911. And they rebuilt it as one of the new steel and concrete horseshoes that had started, I think, with Shibe Park in Philadelphia.
There, you know, there's often talk. Trump used to talk about he had a plan to build the stadium on the waterfront, didn't he?
On the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
In Hudson Yards. Well, there's a Trump city there now. He owned massive amounts of real estate north of the Lincoln Tunnel along the Hudson River.
I mean, the Giants are still playing in New Jersey. Is there a sense that there'll ever be another football stadium in anywhere in the city?
Why?
I wouldn't think that would be the most productive source of revenue per square foot.
Yeah.
The building, how many times a year is that stadium used? 8 home games. Well, that'll be maybe 9 home games, a couple of exhibition games. That's a lot.
Well, I mean, let's face it. They were smart enough for the football teams at least to play together, right? I mean, the double home made so much more sense than having one team play at one stadium on one side of the city and one play on the other.
And still, it's only used 25 times a year.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of college football teams.
Not to dwell on New York sports, but a sort of a revitalization of the New York Knicks. I mean, not to the point where anybody thinks they're a championship team, but at least they're respectable. And it has been, my God, a long time since they were respectable. Knicks basketball was a big, big, big thing. I mean, I don't know how far
I think it still is, Bob. I really think it is still.
I'm not interested in what you
think. Well, how far back do you want to go? Because when I was a kid, it was nothing. When I was a kid, they played NBA doubleheaders.
Yeah, but that was the whole league.
The Knicks would play the second game.
First game
will be Rochester and Philadelphia, the Warriors and the Royals. Second game will be this Syracuse and the Knicks.
Yeah.
Sometimes the first game was the Globetrotters. We go for doubleheaders. But compared to college basketball, the NBA was far distant second in New York.
Well, we also understand that, you know, when Larry O'Brien was the commissioner of the NBA in the late 70s, this league was perilously close to folding.
Days.
Yeah, they were literally. They were on the cusp. And it's historically significant to suggest, and I don't know whether you would agree, Abel, that the arrival of Magic and Bird essentially saved that league. You agree?
I mean, they were dying even after Willis Reed and the Knicks in 70? New York itself didn't save the league?
No, apparently they did not.
I think when you look at what went on in professional basketball through the 70s when we were children,
children, I was married.
Yeah, but you were still a child, Alan. That's what she told you many times. The competing league really threw them into a flux because
I covered the ABA. It was fun.
The ABA played more fun basketball.
They Pistol Pete and Dr. J.
And the 3-point line.
Yeah. And the red, white, and blue ball.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one. I actually missed that ball.
You do not.
No, I do, because on television, you could see it better. That was the days of black and white television, you know, for most people. Color was, you could get color TV, but a lot of people still watched them in black and white. You could see the ball better, which reminds me of something else. The National Football League has gone to a darker football. Have you noticed that, Abel?
No, because my cataracts will prevent me from noticing the difference.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. There is a procedure that you can get done that can assist with that in your advance.
I had it done last year.
How's
your vision now?
I had it done by the guy who wrote the textbook, Johns Hopkins, the leading eye surgeon in the world.
Of course you did. Why would you go to some guy on a street corner, right? When you got connections.
And I said to him, have you ever done this before? And he said, you'll be the fourth. First three didn't go well. I said, we've got a weekend. Could you at least read the textbook? And he came in for the surgery on Monday. He said, I didn't have time to read the textbook. But I watched a video. You should be fine. And one goes from nearsighted to farsighted in a few minutes. And that is
true.
That is extraordinarily unsettling.
Did you have to trade in your glasses for another pair?
Yeah.
You really did, huh?
From nearsighted, from taking glasses off to read, but wearing them driving, to not wearing them driving and putting them on to read. And that's in a flash. It only takes 10 minutes.
The procedure only takes 10 minutes?
Yeah, that's all.
So listen. So we've been been talking for about 20
minutes. Well, the way he did it, yeah.
We're talking for about 20 minutes, and we talked Donald Trump and cataracts. This is great. This is really good.
Well, go ahead. Take the
something for younger viewers.
what is it? As a fair warning or what?
All right, let's discuss Pokemon then. Go ahead, John. Jump in.
You must know more about Pokemon than I do, Bob.
know nothing about it.
I get a phone call every 6 weeks from my son. Dad, did we really throw the Pokemon cards out? They're worth something today.
Everything is allegedly worth something today.
Yeah.
Except the stuff I've got.
I just put all my stuff up for auction, going up for auction in June.
Now, so what now, like what?
Mostly programs.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly programs, press pins, things like that. A couple of what I'm told are rarities, a Negro League scorecard with a lot of autographs on it. Hall of Famers, but no one knows what something is worth. It's worth what, I like to say, it's worth what one person will spend to prevent the other guy from getting it.
That's
the truth in that.
That's in the Lipsy Spartz and Steiner economics textbook, supply and demand.
I was supply never a collector. I always thought, and I think most of my peers thought, that you're sitting with Gretzky in the dressing room or Yogi Berra in the dressing room. You didn't finish your interview and then ask him to sign stuff. I knew only one writer who did and amassed a tremendous collection. But the rest of us, we thought, well, professionals don't do that.
Yeah.
And obviously spent lots of time with all the great sport, not just I, but all of us, sports journalists of that era. Spent a lot of time with Ali and Gretzky and Reggie Jackson. I never thought of saying, would you sign this? And in hindsight, I'm not ashamed that I followed that, but it would have had a lot of stuff worth a lot more money.
So if you and Bob could... We could fill in a week of you two talking about Muhammad Ali. So let's remove Ali from the conversation.
I was talking about his brother, Rahman Ali.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan. By the way, Alan's going to be in Atlantic City for 2 weeks starting Thursday.
Yeah,
so
by the veil.
Who
at the Trump Taj Mahal.
Who other than Ali made an impact on you from the point of view of, I wouldn't mind going back and talking to this guy more, or he made an impact, he made you think more. Is there somebody that jumps out?
I think the somebodies are people who you wouldn't even know if I said their names. Boxers who didn't go very far. I think the whole enterprise is probably very different now. I never wrote about money, contracts, salary caps, didn't write about drugs and suspension and all that. Tried to write about personalities.
Right.
And the most memorable personalities weren't necessarily the guy who was leading the league in goals or scoring or batting. But the fact that they had, baseball players especially, seemed so ordinary physically and had made it to that level, that they were just perplexing to me, because we all loved baseball. We all spent every minute playing baseball that we could. I remember talking to Rick Cerrone. Rick Cerrone was a catcher for the Blue Jays, later for the Yankees. And he'd grown up, I think, in Newark, somewhere across the river in Jersey. And I remember asking him, were you at this certain, there was a famous doubleheader in 1961, the 4th of July, when the Tigers were almost leading the Yankees in the pennant race, and there were 61,000 people. Were you at that game? Were you at Jim Bunning's perfect game at Shea Stadium? Were you at the 23-inning game at Shea? Were you at the game when Mays came back? And he said, I'm going to go to those games. I was playing baseball. And that's why I'm in the major leagues, and you're writing about it.
Oh, interesting.
What we tried to do, because what these people did was completely public. Completely public enterprise. Go out on the ball, get everyone can see you playing. And we tried to find the personal within the public or the private within the public. And probably always failed. Almost always fail. Remember going to see Lloyd Mosby in California after he retired. And he and I were always friendly. I wouldn't say we were friends, but we were friendly and we talked. And I remember saying to him, did I get it? Did I come even close to getting it right? Did I have any sense of what it was like to be doing what you guys did? And he said, you came closer than most of them, but no, you never knew. Nobody knew. Nobody knew whose mom was sick. Nobody knew who's had a fight with their wife that morning. Nobody knew. You knew what happened on the field. You didn't know it. It's impossible to know. I guess in a way it should be impossible.
Yeah.
But it was our job, our enterprise, was to try to make public what the fans in the stands couldn't see. And the people who let you do that people who let you in weren't always the superstars.
We got to take a break. We're going to come back. Alan Abel is with us. We'll be back after these messages. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, Alan Abel is with us from New York.
Washington.
Maryland, somewhere, one of those states.
It's only 49 others.
Yeah, well, I can go through them if you like.
We don't have like that much time, and you can't type Google quick enough.
We have as much time as we want. All they can do is cut us off.
Well, no, that's happened to me, and I get fired, you know, so.
Well, the difference between you and me, I guess, isn't it?
Maybe.
So here's one for you. Best athlete you ever saw?
Well, what's the obvious choice? Bo Jackson. You have to be a great athlete in more than one sport. Who's the member of the superstars, John?
Sure.
Brian Budd. Well, I remember it.
Brian Budd.
Brian Budd won it like a couple times.
He must have been the greatest athlete I ever saw. I don't know. I saw Pele. Well, I saw a guy whose name we're not going to mention anymore. The greatest athlete? Do you remember, when was the first baseball strike? 81?
Ooh. Well, right. Isn't that Black Monday? Isn't that
81?
Yeah.
81.
Anyway,
somehow,
whatever.
Somehow there was some team of Asian cricketers, I guess Indian or Pakistani cricketers, in Toronto, and someone contrived that the Blue Jays, some of their players, would try to hit the bowler, the cricket bowler, and that someone would pitch to the cricket batsman and see if they could hit big league pitching. And as I recall, and this is only 40 years ago, the cricketers couldn't touch a pitched baseball, not even close. But the Blue Jay hitters, which at that point would have been Rance Mullinix and Garth Orange and players like that, hit the cricket bowlers' deliveries all over the place.
Hmm.
And I always, and I think I mentioned Mullinix last time, because he was the guy who said to me, you know why we like you? Because the only one who wears a clean shirt every day. But you looked at ordinary guys like that. I remember going, must have been on a road trip to Oakland, and going to Fisherman's Wharf with Hector Torres, Bob Davis, and Mike Barlow. Again, these aren't men whose names stand out in bronze in Cooperstown. And we were just four guys, same age, probably earning about the same amount of money in 1977, on the BART, going from Oakland to San Francisco, and thinking that these guys are major league ball players. And physically, none of them was especially imposing. Barlow was a tall guy. I think he became a coach at Syracuse, might have played basketball there too. But these are my peers. We have a shared history, except that they are major league ball players. And the gap between them and me in terms of playing baseball was so extraordinary.
Mm.
Yet they were physically unprepossessing.
It's interesting you say that, because you struck two things, Alan, because in my time, I used to pal around and go out to dinner on the road, heck, even on off nights, whatever city I was living in, with players. And we used to make around the same amount of money. So and in this day and age, and particularly in COVID now, we only see players or talk to players electronically.
That's an anomaly.
I'm not sure that we would ever go out to dinner with a player again.
When I covered the Leafs, if I was the first guy in the coffee shop at Swingos Hotel in Cleveland or in Minneapolis, whatever Leaf player came down first would sit with me.
Yeah.
You couldn't imagine that now.
No.
I would think the generation that covered pro sports before me, the Jimmy Cannons and the Scott Youngs, earned more money than the players did. Probably the most. And then, of course, the teams paid their transportation. But
people forget that.
Year and out, we're three Blue Jays, and one of the writers gets on the BART in Oakland and goes to San Francisco to eat.
Yeah.
So refresh my memory. Did you go to spring training in 77 with the Blue Jays?
No, I just came to Toronto in February, and two other guys had gone. I went 78 and onward. But I covered the first game, the snow game.
Yeah. Because that year, everybody stayed at the Countryside Ramada Inn.
On Route 19, right?
Correct. Which was a crummy little kind of hotel motel with one restaurant, which was also the bar. And the players all stayed there, all of them. And the media stayed there, all of them. And the manager and the coaching staff stayed there, all of them. And so at night, there was only one place to go. And essentially what happened was everybody kind of got divided up, at least at the beginning of the night. So the coaches would be over here and the players would be over there and the media would be somewhere else. Well, within half an hour, everybody was kind of together. And it was an intriguing thing because you actually got to know these guys in a way that never happened after that. Second year, by that point, there were maybe 15 or 20 players still staying at the hotel. The rest were off. They'd gotten apartments or condos mm-hmm. or rented houses or whatever. It was a very, very unique season. And I wondered whether you were there for that.
The divide was smaller then. I remember when the Blue Jays traded for Chris Chambliss?
I do.
And somehow I went to his house in Upper Saddle River, New Jersey.
Oh.
I don't know how many reporters now go to ball players' houses, but I remember going to see Hartsfield at home in Alpharetta, Georgia. I guess it depends on access.
Yeah.
I guess that the network TV guys do. They'd be seen more as equals. But I don't think your average newspaper beat reporter, if there even are any anymore, are invited to the all-star players' houses. I wouldn't think so. There was... The word family wasn't mine, but I could tell you a lovely anecdote if you'd like to hear it.
Please.
First year of the Blue Jays, I went on their first Western trip, which I think then was Arlington and the three West Coast cities. And I did, for some reason, did a diary called Just Another Day on the Road about just the mundane activities that a ball team did on the bus or in the hotel or batting practice or just here we are on the road. And that winter, and it was a great success, probably did 7 or 8 columns in a row. And that winter, I thought, I'll do the same thing with the Leafs. And went on a road trip to Cleveland with them, play the Barons.
Mm.
And
Richfield, Ohio.
And they were playing poker on the plane, and Randy Carlyle had just been called up. And they're sitting, he was playing with Mike Pellick or Palmateer, whoever else was in the poker game. And he had in his hand a fistful of American and Canadian $50 and $100 bills. And I described the scene. So I was taking notes of the scene and thought, well, this will make a good installment of Just Another Day on the Road. Here's a kid, probably the first time he's ever had that much physical cash in his hand in his life. He's new, probably Gabby Boudreaux had probably just been called up and Randy Carlyle. And got off the bus in the bowels of the arena in Richfield, Ohio. And Sittler and McDonald walked up to me. And they said, we saw you taking notes on the plane. And what do you plan to do there? Like, we were playing cards and there was money involved. And what's your plan there? I said, well, I had done a series for the Globe and Mail last summer. Well, Just Another Day on the Road. And I thought I would do the Maple Leafs edition of that. And he said, we can't let you do that. That's our private space. That's personal and private things that are going on there. That's not something that should be written about. And then McDonald said something I'll never forget. He said, you know, we like you. And we think that you could be a member of the Maple Leaf family for a long time. And I was 27, had been in the quote, major leagues just a few months. And I had the physical copy of the story that was going to be faxed to the Globe and Mail. And Sittler and McDonald said, you know, if you want to be part of this and have our cooperation, maybe you should tear that up. And in front of them, I went. And McDonald said to me, if there's ever anything you ever need, just ask me. Whether that was a rite of initiation that other reporters had gone through, that I don't know. Was it worth, imagine, I've told that story in journalism classes, and they're appalled.
Just appalled. Sure.
Would you trade a career of acceptance and access over one story that Randy Carlyle is amazed having so much cash in his hand?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would.
You do the same thing I did?
Yes.
I don't know if I would. You know, I got to be honest.
Well, you're thinking 2021. This is 1977.
I would just started, Alan, 1977. And that was my first year working at Hockey Night in Canada.
And I was not overawed by being in the same basement of the Cleveland Arena with Lanny McDonald.
It's a classic. I mean, heck, you live in Washington, D.C. It's a classic case of tit for tat. I mean,
there was no quid pro quo.
Well, no, but he said, if there's anything you need. So, I mean, I'm sure it went a long way. But I think isn't that a reality of day to day trade offs when you do get things? Doesn't that still happen?
One? Yeah. You said you want me to tell you. You want another one?
Yeah.
Third year of the Blue Jays. Remember Tom Buskey?
Sure do. Right-handed pitcher.
Big hulking relief pitcher who'd been with the Yankees, which then was like a badge of exceptionalism. And so he was with the Blue Jays, probably not very happy about it. And it was an off day in Anaheim, and I was sitting with him by the pool to do a feature because he lived right on the riverbank next to Three Mile Island. So here's a feature, right? You're always looking for something interesting on an off day. So Buskey says, we need a new manager. This is the Jays' third year. Roy Hartsfield is still the manager. And Buskey says, we need a new manager. And I said, yeah, sure. He said, write that down. Put it in the story. We need a new manager. And I said, you understand, like you've played in New York, you understand how newspapers work. If you permit me to write that, that's the story. I'm going to write that. It's going to be in the newspaper in Toronto tomorrow. And he said, write it down. Somebody's got to say it. So that was the lead, that was the column that day. And went down to the dressing room after the game in Anaheim. And door was locked. And somebody came out and said, you're not allowed in because of what you did to Buskey. It was Roy Howell was the captain, the third baseman, Roy Howell. And he said, you're no longer having access to this clubhouse because of what you did to Buskey. How could you do that? How could you misquote him? You never would have said anything like that. That was before the game. The paper was already out. And after the game, I went down there again because, well, they didn't pay me to fly to California not to get quotes. And peeped into the doorway, and Howell said, once of them, he said, Buskey told us that you gave him three chances to say he didn't want that in the paper. You gave him three chances, and nobody had ever, ever given anyone a second chance before. If there's ever anything you ever need, just ask us. The next stop was Seattle, and I was standing probably near the batting cage, and Tony Kubek came over and said, all the Mariner players are talking about as if you're the guy who gave a player a second chance.
No.
Right.
I think that's part of the business, Alan. I really do. And I think, you know, I don't have as dramatic a stories as that, but we've had I had a referee in the National Hockey League who was being castigated by the National Hockey League head office come to me and say, I want to read this on the air on Hockey Night in Canada. I want to read it before the game. Will you give me the airtime to read it before the game? I read the article. I read the letter he was going to read on the air. I said, I'm not going to let you do it. Because you're going to have 10 more years of your career. I'm not going to let you ruin your career. Don't be stupid. That happens all the time in our business. There's something more important at times, the human aspect of getting the scoop.
You're talking about a career, but there are lots of reporters who would wear it as a badge of honor that he or she is barred from the Leafs room, barred from the Jays room. I don't know if they still go in the room at all, but there's another another subspecies of sports reporters who are defiantly not part of it, don't want to be part of the family, are looking for every scrap of dirt under the family's carpet. And it wasn't that I had always dreamed of being a member of the Maple Leafs family.
No,
not in any way.
I think there's something to be said for being fair. Don't you?
Well, that's why I was only in my 20s then, of course. Yeah. I tried, I don't want to bring his name up again, but I tried to be fair to the 45th president. I tried to be fair to anyone. I mean, fairness is a pretty fundamental concept. But not if you're a hard-charging editorialist, if you're a muckraker or a scandal uncoverer, then fairness, you may deem fairness to your reader or to the taxpayers more important than fairness to the junior senator from Montana in that way.
Hey, got to ask you, difference between sports and Washington. Is there a difference?
Sports, you'd have to say it's a different. What's the difference between covering sports in the 70s and 80s?
Okay.
And covering Washington in the 2010s.
Okay.
One tremendous difference that I found. I remember when I came to Toronto, I thought if I'm covering the Leafs and I have to go to the washroom and the Leafs score, no one's going to tell me what happened. No one in the press box, and it was exactly the opposite. It was a spirit of collegiality, of partnership, of how can I help? How can we help you? And I found at least at my level in the Capitol Hill and the White House press corps exactly the opposite. It was grimly, bitterly, divisively competitive. I'm sure within, at the top level, I'm sure the TV correspondents all were as collegial, not trading scoops with each other. But I found it joyless. I was in awe every day that I was in the Capitol Rotunda or in the White House briefing room. Not out of, maybe I was raised with sappy patriotic values or something. Or Parliament Hill, for that matter. I spent time in Parliament Hill. Here I am, a beneficiary of this system. And right here. And I remember John McCain would always give me a wink because I had been a park ranger where he had a houseboat in Arizona. And here's the guy who he could have been president.
Yeah.
I remember I took my daughter year when Trump was in office to take your child to work day. So I took her to the Rose Garden and they invited the children of the press corps, which Obama's people never had done. And as she went up to get the president's autograph, I said to tell the president that you were born in one of his father's apartment buildings. And he looked at me, he said, must have been a great apartment. And I said, you should know your father sent you there to kill the roaches. Never mind that. what's the difference? I'll give you an honest answer. When I first got to the Capitol, there's a little subway, a two-car subway, that goes between the Capitol building and the Senate office buildings. And at lunchtime or at a break in Senate hearings, all the senators take that train out and they bring it back. So the reporters stand, 20, 30, 40, 60 of us, stand where that train stops by the little escalator that goes up to the Senate building. And in that way, it is exactly the same as covering sports. Mm-hmm. It is, go to some Republican senator, Mitch McConnell, right? Mitch McConnell says something about the farm bill. And the Republican says something, then you run to Chuck Schumer. Everyone runs it. Did you hear what he said about the farm bill? Which is no different from, did you hear what the shortstop said about the catcher?
Right.
In that way, it was scrum journalism. It was grab bait for quotes. In that way, pretty much the same. And I was surprised at that. I didn't think that the Times and the Post and Politico and those and the networks begged for quotes the way someone from the National Post or Toronto would beg for quotes. But it was pretty much just chase them. Now it's hold up the recorder, hold up the phone, pray that they're going to say something interesting. In the same way that you'd go to the starting pitcher and pray that he says something interesting.
Right. I hate to do this to you, but we're dead out of time.
You know what this means?
We got to bring you back again at some point.
You don't got it.
Well, we will if you will. Thank you, Mr. Abel. Lovely to see you and talk to you again, and be well, okay?
Okay, I'll wear a jacket again too next time.
Good.
Attaboy.
Good, good.
Alan Abel, back to rap after this. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, here to wrap it up. Again, our thanks to Alan Abel for joining us. I could sit and listen to Abel's stories all day, and Abel would take all day to tell all his stories.
We might have to do an Abel week. How's that? Abel week.
I don't know
about on the Bob McCowan podcast.
I don't know.
He's great. You know, Alan and I work together a lot. Hockey Night in Canada, Olympics, and I think he's one of the greatest storytellers that has ever worked in Canada. I really
he's the best sports writer I've ever read. Yeah. And I'm certainly in Canada, and with due respect to others, but he's as good as they get, folks. If you missed him, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Pick up one of his books and you'll get a sense of his skill with the written word. That'll do it for us.
Hey, tomorrow, Bob, you know what we're going to do? We're going to dissect the trade deadline. We're going to dissect it.
Fantastic. We could have done that on Saturday.
No, it's changing every day.
We'll see you next time. Goodbye, everybody.